Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. Today I want to talk about the Profumo scandal and what it meant for early 60s Britain, and why what is a fairly trivial ministerial indiscretion turns out to become the great defining political scandal of the 1960s, and also the kind of the great sex scandal of the modern era. And, you know, what this tells us, not so much about Profumo or Christine Keeler, but about the climate of Macmillan's Britain by 1963. So the facts of the case. In 1961, John Profumo, Minister for War, not a particularly high-up position within the War Office, but a fairly respected establishment figure, a man who had a good war career himself, was married to the glamorous actress Valerie Hobson, and was not destined perhaps for great office, but was a kind of a relied member of the government, trusted member of the government, encounters at his friend William Astor's magnificent country home, Cliveden House in Buckinghamshire, a young call girl, Christine Keeler. Profumo initiated the affair. He left a note, passed on a note through Astor to get in touch with her. And society osteopath Stephen Ward really fixed everybody up. He was the kind of Christine Keeler, who's her patron. It was imputed, though there turns out to be less and less evidence for this. It was imputed that he was really her pimp, but he denied, and it looks like was right in denying obtaining any monies for the liaison. So the affair itself lasted little more than a month. It was, in her words, a screw of convenience, pardon the language. And the amount of time they spent together was relatively slim. I think he gave her a number of gifts, perhaps a little bit of money, but really nothing of particular importance. She had been seeing beforehand a Soviet naval attaché in Britain called Eugene Ivanov. Eugene Ivanov was essentially a Soviet spy, and MI5 had their eye on him, hoping that he could be persuaded by Stephen Ward to defect. There was no overlap between Christine Keeler between Ivanov and Profumo. And the idea that Christine Keeler would be handing on state secrets is laughable, really. Though this, when the scandal broke, was the line that some of the newspapers took. The relationship by 1961, later 1961, was an open secret. And after a word with the chief whip, Profumo quickly abandoned the liaison. And this was by no means the only bit of kind of salacious gossip going on Westminster at the time. There were numerous affairs on both Labour and Conservative sides, and the press barons who were so quick to leap on the Profumo scandal were mired in scandal themselves. In the early 1960s, the affair was a much guarded secret, and very often when newspaper editors heard about the private lives of politicians, they took the executive self-censoring decision to not mention it or to keep it out of the front pages, because these were the people that the likes of Lord Beaverbrook, for example, shared private members' clubs with. Christine Keeler and her friend Mandy Rice Davis both shared some fairly unpalatable company and mixed in circles that one might describe as criminal. The slum landlord, the infamous slum landlord of London, Peter Rackman, was an associate and one-time lover of both women. In August 1961, John Profumo broke off the affair, writing a letter to Christine Keeler, starting with the word darling, which was later used to bring Profumo down. Sir Norman Brooke, the Cabinet Secretary, had mentioned to Profumo, without raising the question of the affair, but implying it strongly, that the circles he was moving in, particularly Stephen Ward's circles, were not suitable for a cabinet minister, particularly one in his position, and that it couldn't be guaranteed that Ward was entirely trustworthy. Keeler claims, and I think this is probably nonsense, Keeler claims that Stephen Ward was asking her to obtain nuclear secrets. But Stephen Ward was a playboy and an osteopath. He wasn't a spymaster. And if he was, one can hardly think of a worse choice of spy than Christine Keeler, who was, you know, simply a good time girl in 60s London. So that one is probably a figment of her imagination and the kind of thing one sells to the newspapers after the event when you're trying to raise a few quid. The scandal itself only starts to really appear in the gossip columns a year later, in about July 1962, by which time Christine Keeler is embarked upon a relationship with a black jazz singer called Lucky Gordon, who she's met in Notting Hill whilst with Stephen Ward trying to score some cannabis. And the fact that there was now in the story a black immigrant petty criminal, Lucky Gordon had been done for a number of small-time offences, would really pique the interest of the tabloid press, particularly at a time when Britain was starting to feel the kind of the impact of immigration from the West Indies in terms of a shift towards anti-immigration movements, and later as we get to the 1960s, we see sort of like a hardening of racist attitudes. So this kind of angle on the story when it broke was of particular salacious interest to British tabloid readers. The second boyfriend of Keeler's, another West Indian sailor, George Edgecombe, in a violent attack, turned up at the front door and emptied the contents of a revolver into it. And this seems to have kind of pushed her over the edge somewhat, she seems to have experienced some kind of stress, some kind of traumatic kind of breakdown at this point. And in moments of drunken indiscretion around the nightclubs of London, in her role as a kind of a hostess and a call girl, begins to tell her story, and unfortunately starts to tell it to a former Labour MP, who then passes it on to a colleague in the House, thus beginning an investigation. Now, the actual kind of tittle-tattle, the who-did-what-to-who bit of this whole story isn't really the interesting part. The interesting part of the Profumo scandal is the context. Now, this was not a spy scandal. You know, despite what anyone might say, it's not a spy scandal. No secrets were passed, and John Profumo didn't really actively engage in espionage in any way at all. In fact, nobody did, even though one person involved was a spy. But there had been successive spy scandals, from the blackmailing of the gay British civil servant John Vassal, who was a naval attaché in Moscow in the 1950s, all the way through to the defection of Burgess McLean and Philby in the years just in the run-up to the Profumo scandal. The thing about the Cambridge spies was that there was a strong sense that they had been covered up for. Their activities had been covered up by their colleagues. Kim Philby was the head of counterintelligence in MI6 and a good former Westminster schoolboy had been able to pull the wool over the eyes of his colleagues since the Second World War. However, it took really the FBI a relatively short space of time to point the finger at him, thus the implication always being that in both MI5 and MI6 there were either A, more Soviet moles, or B, more likely, people who knew full well what was happening and either were using Philby to feed duff information to the Soviets, or they were simply too embarrassed to name Philby, or there was an old-school Thai loyalty. And the publications like Private Eye went down the final option, that really there was some kind of establishment elitism bordering on treachery. Now, the Macmillan government seemed to be peculiarly tainted with this. There was a sense in the early 1960s, as we are moving towards a kind of a more egalitarian era, an era of John Osborne and Alan Sillitoe plays where being working class is terribly cool, that there's something deeply corrupt or corrupting or decadent or incompetent about the upper classes. Part of this was really kind of Harold Wilson's spin as Labour approached the 1964 general election and, was desperate not to lose a fourth one on the trot. In many ways, though, this decline in deference, really, and this decline in respect for the automatic right of the upper classes to be seen as heirs and betters was really the result of post-war affluence. And if you go back a few podcasts, I've done a whole thing on Macmillan's Never Had It So Good Britain from 1954 onwards. The generation that lived after the war saw an increase in living standards pretty much unprecedented in British history. Certainly one which I doubt in scale and scope that we will see. Though we are the kind of inheritors of that and live even generally nicer standards of living than they did. However, it's that increase from the experience of the Depression, the experience of wartime austerity, through to post-war affluence. It radically and dramatically changed attitudes, particularly among younger people. One of the defining features of cultural features of the era was the growth in satire. Things like That Was the Week That Was and Beyond the Fringe made a kind of an industry out of mocking and ridiculing the elites. We have this curious Britain where for a decade after the war, well, a decade and a half, we have this wonderful kind of stability. And this sense that we have prosperity, a welfare state that's functioning, a healthy balance of payments, although by 1964 that's definitely going for a Burton. And unfortunately for Macmillan, this wonderful stability generates the degree, the kind of affluence that creates new attitudes, that makes people look to their social heirs and betters wearing tweeds and striding the grouse moors and think, well, they're anachronistic, old-fashioned, and we need to get rid of them. Wilson was, if Wilson had any genius at all, it was being able to position himself as the kind of the architect of all that is new and modern. And his kind of spin machine was really New Labour before there was a New Labour. Profumo, of course, denied the affair, and he denied it to the Chief Whip and then to the Prime Minister himself. But obviously, when details of the facts of the affair came to light in the press, he was forced to issue a retraction and was in front of the House and was publicly shamed. the affair caused Ivanov to be recalled back to Moscow in disgrace. The British tabloid press were went into sort of this kind of frenzy of lurid story writing, not just about Profumo, but about the rest of the upper class, sordid parties where sadomasochistic events involving jars of bees and all sorts of crazy things occurred. And there was a lurid interest in upper class decadence for a brief period of time. Much of it was made up, much of it was nonsense, but supposedly some of it's true, but you know, we don't really need to go down that route, I don't think. The interesting thing about moral panics, however, I think, is this. It's not whether any of it's true. I mean, that's largely irrelevant. It's why people read them. It's why people flock to them. And I think one of the things about the Profumo scandal is the degree of moral panic that surrounded it. You know, a respectable gentleman, a figure of the establishment, had been caught lying to Parliament and carrying on with a young girl. And there were various press reports, you know, people writing into the newspapers saying, you know, this is outrageous. I mean, a girl of her age. And people looked to their own children, their own teenagers, with kind of a sense of concern and anxiety. And of course, we have this huge new generation in the 1960s of young people, the post-war baby boom. So it's hardly surprising that a moral panic kind of develops around youth. And obviously, it's not the only moral panic surrounding youth at the time. You know, people are writing the Sun and the Big Violence, it's not published yet, but the Mirror is writing all sorts of lurid stories about mods and rockers smashing up Clacton and, you know, running amok and that kind of thing. So there is, within this, you know, rather pleasurable period of affluence, all sorts of anxieties about the conduct of private life, about propriety in political circles, about relationships and sexuality and the vulnerability of youth and all sorts of things, even espionage, that's largely a nonsense, exist. People find a lot to be worried about. And really, I think what they're worried about is a thing that they can't put their finger on, a thing that's kind of invisible, that people can't see, but it's there anyway. And they're really worried about the pace of change around them, how Britain is being rapidly transformed over in a short period of time because of the wealth it is experiencing and what that's doing to it culturally. And one of the reasons why I can be confident about this is because by the end of the 60s, and just sort of 5 or 6 years later, there's this huge cultural backlash against much of what has been seen as permissive by the 1960s. If there are two bookmarks to the 60s, at one end you've got John Profumo, and the other end you've got Mary Whitehouse, and we'll talk about her another time. In the long run, the Profumo scandal didn't do Macmillan's government that much harm. A series of economic failings in terms of devaluation and stop-go, and the inability to get Britain into Europe because of Charles de Gaulle's veto, are really what set the government back and made it possible for the government to lose in 64. Macmillan falls ill towards the end of 63. With some manner of gallbladder complaint, I think it was, but I'm not a doctor, and is replaced by Alec Douglas Hume, who is more Etonian than any Tory PM has ever been, and really, whilst a pretty competent Prime Minister and a pretty well-respected guy all round, still doesn't fit the bill for the mood of the times, and it is easy bait for Wilson, who portrays the party, the Conservatives as the party of the grouse moors. The Profumo scandal was a year later was largely forgotten in electoral terms, but it kind of lingers on with us, and it lingers on with us, I guess, in part because it created the kind of the underpinnings of the modern tabloid culture, the modern tabloid sex scandal, which, you know, people are largely bored and disinterested in now, because it's all so de rigueur and so mundane and so so predictable. I mean, who cares, really? Anyway, that brings us to the end of this little chit-chat for today. And I've got some interesting stuff to bring up. We've got a couple of new titles hopefully coming out by the end of the year. A new writer who's coming on board with Explaining History, Gina Bolter, will be writing us a history of China after Mao from 1976 to the 1990s, which I'm personally really looking forward to reading. We've got Julia Routledge's The Genocidal Century is just making its way to us fairly soon. And we've also got a new title from William Sweeney, looking at the destructive century, looking at warfare and the war industries throughout the 20th century. So I hope to have those with you by Christmas time. Also, check out what's happening with the new Explaining History Facebook page. I'm posting really good video on there at the moment, mine and other people's. You can join in the conversation. There's lots and lots of stuff to look at and download off there. You might also find the Explaining History video channel. I'm going to put a link underneath this podcast, so get yourself there. I'm putting lots of stuff on there about essay skills and that kind of thing. Anyway, thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next podcast. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.